You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're zooming in now on news in the western part of our state. Here are some of the things we'll be touching on. Corn and soybean yields and how farmers are doing right now. The status of that proposed Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin. And we start with the shipping delays on the Mississippi River. Do you run a business that's been affected by shipping delays? How much did it compromise your business last year? And do you think the government should have done more to speed up the shipping channel? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in now. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse, and she joins us from our studios there. Hope, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the weather and shipping on and farmers. A record-breaking amount of water caused major shipping delays on the Mississippi last year. Let's listen to Doug Hazu, president of the Upper Mississippi Waterway Association. That's a shipping trade group.
We've had floods, certainly, in the past and high water. That's not uncommon, but it's usually, you know, two, three weeks and business as usual. And that just really was never the case.
So just how unusual were the river's water levels last year?
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers tracked around 25 trillion gallons of water going through Lock and Dam 10 at Guttenberg, Iowa. That is well above the previous high that was set in 1993. And by comparison, the average is about 12 trillion. So a really large jump in the amount of water we're seeing going through the Mississippi River.
Then, okay, so how does the shipping industry get affected by that rising water?
Yeah, so when we have high water, it basically forces barges to tow fewer forces boats to tow fewer barges. So they could go from a 12 to 15 barge tow to down to about a 9 barge tow in high waters. It also makes some docks inaccessible for these boats. They just don't fit under the spouts to load up whatever commodity that they are shipping up the river. And so it basically forces the shipping industry to kind of rethink their logistics of where they're loading barges and where they're docking them.
And did that bear out in the number of commodities being shipped?
It absolutely did. There was the number of commodities was about 25% lower than the 10-year average shipped on the river this year.
And then you talked with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which has the job of dredging the Mississippi River to maintain the navigation channels. How did the water levels affect their work?
Yeah, so when in times of flooding of high waters, it forces a lot more sediment into the waterways. And so the St. Paul District ended up dredging about 1 million cubic yards of dredge material, which is enough to fill Lambeau Field.
Wow.
So a lot of dredge material coming out of the river just in the St. Paul District alone. And so there was also a need to dredge more on the river in our area. But actually, the St. Paul District ended up sending two of their dredges south of downriver to the St. Louis area and also down to the state of Mississippi because of more serious flooding down there and the need for more dredging there. And so that forced the St. Paul District to actually narrow the navigation channel that they maintain on the river. They're tasked with maintaining a 9-foot depth, but they ended up bringing that more in a more narrow channel so they could just keep up with the pace that was needed.
And a narrow channel, I assume, means less traffic running through that channel.
Yeah, again, that just impacts the shipping industry's logistics, the way they're thinking about shipping, and you know, forces them to have to get a little more creative and, you know, really impacts shipping times on the Mississippi River.
So did you find that the Army Corps of Engineers, that they have enough resources to keep up with the dredging demand?
So the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, they said this was definitely an unusual year for them. Obviously, anytime you have a record high, that's unusual. But, you know, they say they were able to keep pace by narrowing the channel and just really staying on top of things, anticipating where we might see the need for more dredging. Just the number of locations on the river were also impacted. They saw, you know, more locations needing dredging than is typically needed in a summer.
We're catching up with WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. Hope Kerwin is with us sharing some of her recent reporting. Do you grow corn or soybean crops in Wisconsin? How was your harvest last year? What issues did you see throughout the year? And what do you hope will be different this year, 2020? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Hope, the weather also wasn't kind to Wisconsin farmers in 2019. You looked at that government data tracking corn and soybean harvests. What did you learn about harvesting last year compared to the past?
Yeah, this was the second slowest harvest pace on record for corn and soybeans this year. You know, crops ended up being about 3 weeks behind the average, and that was pretty consistent from spring all the way to harvest. You know, we saw really wet soils the previous fall heading into winter, and that just really set us up for some really late planting once we saw, you know, snow melting on top of saturated soils, and then just another really high precipitation spring impacted farming that way. So with that delayed planting, that just really set farmers up to continue to be behind almost, you know, all growing season long.
So as you talked to them, they couldn't get into their fields. What were they doing?
Yeah, I mean, it was historically delayed planting, not only in Wisconsin, but really across the Midwest. It was, you know, we saw kind of a record number of prevented planting acres filed through crop insurance. And, you know, when fields are wet, farmers can't get their machinery out because it causes ruts in the fields and really does a lot of damage. And so it's a delicate balance. They really need to wait for those fields to be in prime condition to start doing work. So for a lot of them, it was a waiting game in the spring. And you know, a lot of waiting also come harvest time of waiting for those conditions to be prime as well.
And so if you're so behind schedule with a slow pace of harvest this year, how could that affect this or, you know, next year's crops?
Yeah, so because, you know, crops were delayed and we saw harvest delayed, that really impacted people who do who till their fields in the fall in preparation for the spring. I talk with some crop experts who actually say that more and more farmers are getting away from fall tilling because there's new science that's starting to show that it's not as beneficial as it has been thought in the past. But that does set some people up who prefer to till their fields before planting, and it could impact spring planting. I think a lot of that will also depend on what kind of winter we get.
So last year wasn't all bad for news for farmers. Egg producers set a record high in November. What was behind that?
Yeah, so when I talked to egg producers about this record high set for November, you know, they mentioned that they really feel like the drive for cage-free eggs has actually helped some of this expansion. You know, they pointed out that some of the larger egg producers in our state have really invested in cage-free operations. And so that could be behind this bump we saw, not only in November, but also another record high set the previous month in October. And so, you know, we're definitely seeing egg production kick up a little bit in the state. Wisconsin's not, you know, necessarily a top egg producer, I would say, in the U.S., but we're up there. And, you know, they said that this drive for cage-free eggs from, you know, major food companies, from mayonnaise companies to all the way to McDonald's, you know, they're really driving this demand for cage-free eggs.
So is it market forces that perhaps is starting to drive up egg production here in the state?
Yeah, I definitely would say that drive from, you know, big corporations like McDonald's, mayonnaise companies, you know, they're looking for cage-free eggs because consumers are looking for, you know, those types of products. They see the, you know, the demand from consumers to make maybe what some would say is more, you know, responsible production choices. And so they see this as a market to invest in as a way to attract customers.
Well, for the soybean farmers and the corn farmers, will they need government assistance with in terms of being so behind with their harvest and yields not maybe being what they should be? What will government assistance look like?
Well, we've seen, you know, new forms of government assistance this, you know, this year and last year in the form of market facilitation payments or trade aid payments going to farmers. You know, we also saw some, you know, obviously prevented planting, what I mentioned earlier. You know, that's a crop insurance program where farmers can't get their fields planted on schedule. You know, they're able to file for some money through their crop insurance programs. So we've seen that form of government assistance. But you know, at the end of the day, it also might just be farmers, you know, kind of eating the difference of not having as high of yields or as productive as crops as we've seen in previous years.
And you talk with farmers a lot. Are there any ag success stories that you've been reporting on this past year in an otherwise really difficult year?
You know, I think we've seen farmers across the industry having to get creative in times of not only in hard growing years, you know, like we've had this year, but also, you know, the last several years of low prices, you know, kind of across the industry. You know, we've seen a lot of farms having to get creative and cut back expenses and, you know, really just kind of build their resiliency. I think we see a lot more interest from the ag community lately in helping farms build resiliency to low prices, you know, helping farms think about their farm financials and, you know, being smart with their input costs to kind of best maximize their production. And, you know, I think that that's going to continue to be a trend, even though we do see, you know, things like milk prices starting to come up. Mm-hmm. I think farms really recognize they need to, you know, build that resiliency.
We have WPR's reporter in La Crosse as our guide. Hope Kerwin is with us. What do you think of how universities are responding to campus sexual assault misconduct? Should universities be doing more to help victims and hold offenders accountable? What problems do you see in how colleges handle sexual misconduct cases? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with WPR journalist Hope Kerwin here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, we're moving through developments in the western part of our state here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We'll talk about Congressman Ron Kind's reaction to the impeachment inquiry, the status of the massive Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line, and let's start with UW-La Crosse's response to a sexual harassment probe. Here are some questions to weigh in on. What do you think of the proposed massive transmission line through southwestern Wisconsin? How about Congressman Ron Kind's voting in favor of impeachment? Do you support his vote or are you against it? And what do you think of how universities are responding now to campus sexual misconduct? Should they be doing more to help victims and help offenders be accountable? Join in 800-642-1234. WPR reporter Hope Kerwin stays with us from our La Crosse studios. Hope, you've been reporting on the UW-La Crosse's response to sexual harassment after the student reported being harassed by the college's art department chair. Here's that student, Casey Bean, at a recent news conference.
My story, the first time that I came forward with it to UWL, was exactly the same as the second time. So that just shows that there's something broken within the UWL system.
So let's back up here. What did Casey Bean report to the university, and how did the school respond?
Yeah, this all started back in September when Bean made a public Facebook post claiming that at the time, an unnamed art professor, who we now know as Joel Elgin, had sexually harassed her as a freshman. And she said that she had come forward to UWL in the previous March and reported that sexual harassment. But, you know, she claims that university officials did not communicate with her over the course of that investigation that summer, and that she had to be the one to reach out to the university to find out the results of that investigation. And she really just felt that the UWL's response was inadequate, that they didn't do enough to protect her and protect other students from this, you know, this harasser.
And the Arts Department Chair, Joel Elgin, had retired while he was under investigation. How has he responded to these allegations?
Yeah, so UWL Chancellor Joe Gao first announced that Joel Elgin was retiring in December as this investigation into him, I would say the second investigation that happened after Casey Bean made that public Facebook post in September. It was announced that Elgin was retiring. Later, his attorney issued a statement on his behalf saying that Elgin had cooperated with university, investigators and had planned to meet with the chancellor to talk about the results of that investigation and also face a faculty review until a university attorney reminded him that some of his retirement benefits were at risk the university were to take action against him, he could lose some of those retirement benefits. You know, Elgin claims that those were worth thousands of dollars in retirement and that he didn't want to risk that that benefit to himself and to his family. And so that was why he retired. But, you know, he really maintained that these allegations were false and kind of warned other faculty as well that the university would not protect them against, you know, potentially false allegations.
And the chancellor said there's going to be a forum to answer questions on this. Has that happened?
That has not happened yet. Chancellor Gao said when he announced that Joe Elgin was retiring, you know, Gao said that he hoped to eventually release the results of that second investigation into Elgin and host a campus forum to talk about the investigation, this issue, and really hear student and faculty's complaints or concerns.
What are those concerns, especially among the students?
Yeah, so I think what we've heard from Bean and from other students is a need for more transparency on behalf of the university when it comes to responding to sexual harassment. They feel, I've heard the sentiment that they feel the university kind of tried to keep this under wraps and, didn't want to release a lot of information about what was happening. And they just really felt that the university's initial response to Bean's complaint was inadequate and did not do enough to protect her and other students.
We're talking with WPR's lacrosse reporter Hope Kerwin. She's bringing us up to speed on some of her recent reporting in the western part of the state. Hope, let's switch to another really big story you've been covering, and that's the proposed $500 million Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin. Opponents of the transmission line filed a lawsuit to block it. Here's their lawyer, Howard Lerner.
They should not have been hearing that case, and we believe that's just a matter of law. It's a matter of good policy, and it's a matter of common sense.
So give us some context here. What is Lerner saying about Wisconsin's Public Service Commission?
Yeah, so, Lerner's organization, they filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. They are claiming that the Public Service Commission should not have approved the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. And they were also challenging...
Which was approved back in September.
Correct. Yeah. And they are challenging also the decision by two commissioners on the PSC to not recuse themselves from that case. So the environmental groups claim that PSC Chair Rebecca Cameron Vock and Commissioner Mike Hipsch, they should have recused themselves because they had connections to utility groups supporting the project. Vock had previously served as a regulatory counsel for Wheat Energies, which is a parent company of one of the owners of this line. And Hipsch is currently a member of an advisory committee for another utility group kind of advocating for the Cardinal Hickory Creek line. And so, they really felt like those commissioners should recuse themselves from the decision and therefore the decision should not stand.
So what happens next in this case?
Yeah, so, this obviously will go before a federal court and continue through that process. We've also seen, these same groups file a lawsuit in state court as well on the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. And so, you know, this will obviously play out in the courts. So far, the Public Service Commission, while they have not commented on this litigation because they don't comment on pending litigation, you know, they have kind of pointed back to their decision in September where the commission dismissed this motion that was filed by these two environmental groups on the same issue. You know, the commission found that the claims had no merit, and they also questioned the timing of their motion. Given that, you know, the commission had already partially approved the project. And so they really felt like, you know, this was kind of a Hail Mary last minute motion to try to stop that decision.
You've also been keeping an eye on Iowa and what they're doing, because this line would stretch from Madison to Dubuque. What is the status of getting this through in Iowa?
So the Iowa Utilities Board did hold some public meetings in December in Dubuque, which is where this line would connect, as they're kind of considering the project. And so, you know, because this line stretches across state lines, you know, that Utilities Board will also need to approve this project.
Well, you've also been doing some reporting on the ice and ice fishing. How does it look out there in the western part of the state?
Yeah, so on the western side of the state where I'm at, ice fishing is really popular on the Mississippi River. But, you know, I talked to a conservation warden with the DNR, and, you know, she said that the ice is really kind of not what we normally would see as far as depth or thickness. You know, she mentioned that a lot of the, you know, just precipitation we've been getting recently has actually raised water levels. And in some areas, that water's above the ice now. And so it's really just kind of an unusual year. And ice conditions, as she described them, can be a little unpredictable. We're also seeing some kind of abnormal or unpredictable conditions in central and northern Wisconsin as well, where we see a lot of snow on the ground. That really heavy snowpack, you know, creates kind of an insulating layer in the ice. And according to, you know, fishing guides I talked to there, and, you know, the ice just really doesn't grow that depth that it normally does. And it also creates kind of a slushy layer, and it's not really fun to be on.
Well, Hope, thanks so much for joining us, getting
thanks
us up to speed.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse. We've been recapping some of her recent stories on shipping and farms, sexual harassment, ice fishing, and she joined us from our studios there in La Crosse. Just ahead, we take a look at a driving course in Wisconsin that lets you practice your winter driving skills. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.